Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire's opioid crisis means a rising number of children removed from homes where drug abuse is occurring and placed in foster care. But the system is struggling to keep up. More foster parents are needed, and once recruited, it takes time and resources to get them screened, licensed, and trained. Meanwhile, the state is short of social workers to process these cases and to work with foster families. However, given the spotlight now on our child protection system, there are stepped-up efforts to address these issues. And we'll find out more this hour as we check in on foster care in New Hampshire. Let's get your questions, concerns, and especially personal stories into our conversation. Join us 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have four guests in studio. Kelly Smith is here, clinical social worker with more than 25 years experience working with adoptive and foster families. And Kelly, it's always good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us, Jeanette Burge, program director and a social worker at Child and Family Services, a New Hampshire nonprofit. She works with foster care families. And Jeanette, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Also with us, Deb Urbaitis. She's a foster adoptive parent and an attorney who specializes in family law. And Deb, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Eileen Mullen, administrator at DCOIF, where she works with foster families and children. And Eileen, good to meet you too. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Laura.
Well, and Eileen, I did want to start with you. We've talked so much on this program about broader problems at DCYF, staffing shortages, how hard it is to do the work you need to do because it's so hard to fill these positions. How's it going now?
Oh, Laura, thanks for the question. I guess the first thing I would like to talk about is May is Foster Care Month. This is a month where we really celebrate all those wonderfully brave families that we have that work with our kids and families. The system, you know, of course, has challenges. Our families, of course, have had those challenges. Overall, I think we're moving right along. We're staying fixed on our goals. We're trying to stay focused on the work that we do and still try to provide as much support that we can for our families and meet the needs of those children that are coming into the system.
And are more kids coming into the system, Eileen? That's
yes.
What I've heard.
Yes, Laura. We've seen about a 30% increase of kids entering the system as I can't say it's all a result of the opioid crisis in the state, but we have had a significant increase, which, of course, puts strain on the child welfare system, the juvenile justice system, the mental health systems, medical systems. Child welfare doesn't operate in a vacuum. We're really dependent upon a lot of systems.
Right. 30%. That's
30%,
huge.
Yes.
Now that's from, like, over the past year or or 3 years? Or?
I'm sorry. That would be over the last state fiscal year.
Wow. Yes. That's a big increase over a year.
It is a big increase.
So do you have right now, Eileen, the staff that it takes to manage this?
We have strategically made a lot of changes in how we're dealing with the whole foster and adoptive care system. And I need to make it clear that when I talk about foster care, I'm also talking about our adoptive system as well, because primarily our foster parents are our adoptive parents if, in fact, that child is legally freed for adoption further down the way. So we have, to date, we have about 1,200 kids in out-of-home placement. And of those 1,200 children, about 430 of them are in foster care. And what we've seen, a real dramatic increase, is in relative care providers. So children, you know,
grandma, aunts, uncles,
grandparents. So we have about 400 kids who are in relative care placement at this point in time.
The other thing I've heard about, Eileen, is that the average age of kids in foster care is getting younger. This is nationally, I've seen this. So is this
That's
happening
true.
In New Hampshire?
That is
as
happening
well?
In New Hampshire. You know, it's interesting that you would bring up that point. I would happen to be in Manchester at a foster and adoptive parent association meeting, and I was looking around the room, and there were about 20 infants and young children who accompanied those foster families to this meeting. That was very, very alarming and surprising to me, because in the past, it's usually older kids that are entering our system. And when I say older, at least, age 12 months and up.
Wow, it's heartbreaking.
It is. Little babies and toddlers. But yes, just to see them interacting with these wonderful families that are taking care of them and nurturing them and working with their birth families to see if, we can get those kids reunified if possible. Well, so maybe. It is heart-wrenching, but just to see all the love and all the sharing going on amongst foster parents was a beautiful, enlightening moment.
Well, Kelly, as I said, you've been working in this system from the outside as a clinical social worker for a long time. What changes have you seen?
Probably in the last year or two, I think what I've seen is the need for foster parents. And what happens a lot of times is kids will come into an emergency foster care situation and they'll be there for a couple days or weeks and then they'll move and then they may move again. And what that means for a kid is just a lot of transition. But for our school age kids, it's horrific. They have to keep moving schools.
That's hard.
Or therapists or things like that. So I can't say enough about our foster parents and foster adoptive parents who do this amazing work. I always say it's the hardest job and the most rewarding job out there. But we need foster parents badly, because I can't have a kid go from Manchester to Plymouth and then back down to Nashua. And it really is about the shortage.
How severe is the shortage, and is it getting worse?
I think it's up there. I think there's a great need for foster parents. And so many foster parents, social workers, CASAs. There's so many different pieces that are needed, because the need has increased so much.
Well, and Deb, as I said at the beginning, you're a foster adoptive parent, as well as an attorney who specializes in family law. What's your perspective about how well the foster care system is able to respond to the challenges that Eileen and Kelly presented?
Well, at least our experience is it was a pretty tough system to be in. I think that generally they do a good job, but sometimes there are holes and sometimes things happen really quickly. We got our little girl on an emergency basis, just like Kelly was just talking about, and when things have to happen quickly, sometimes things get missed or get lost in that process. And really, it creates a difficult situation for the foster family bringing in a little person who maybe you don't have a lot of information about. So
tell us your story, or as much as you feel comfortable sharing, Deb.
Sure. So we received a little girl in our care about 15 months ago, and we have since adopted her. She's now 7 years old. And quite the little spitfire, and that's saying it sort of mildly, that we got her on an emergency basis. And we were originally told, she's a little busy, she's a little inquisitive. She was totally dysregulated. The poor little child had come out of another very short placement, kind of like Kelly was saying. And so when she got to us, the poor little child, she was only five at the time, had been in one home for a while, then moved to another home, then to our home. And so the poor kid was totally dysregulated, and she has a number of disabilities, so she was really very difficult, running around the house, I would almost say foaming at the mouth, putting everything in the mouth that she could. She instantly, on walking in the door, started hitting my older son and was acting out in some ways that are very inappropriate. And I remember pulling her off of Levi, and I looked at the social worker, and I kind of went, what is going on here? And they kind of looked a little shocked. They didn't really have a lot to say to me at that point. And I said, what's going on? And her CASA said, well, maybe she needs a med adjustment.
CASA, again, is court-appointed special advocates.
Exactly.
Yeah, go ahead.
And he had been with her for a long time. Wonderful, wonderful human. So it was a tough situation to have her be that dysregulated, very violent. She swore a lot. And my 10-year-old now looked at me and says, Mom, that's the baddest word in Henniker. And I laughed. I said, yeah, probably that was. But she said that about 100 times before the night was over.
Wow.
So it was a very difficult beginning. And so we had a lot of struggle right at the beginning getting information. We didn't know what was wrong. And it was very clear something was wrong with her. So about 7 days in, we wound up at Concord Hospital because she was hurting herself, tried to break her nose on her bed frame, trying to break the windows out of the house. There was something wrong. So we went to the hospital and said, oh, we don't know what to do. And there was a fabulous worker from Riverbend in the ER who helped sort some of that out. And we finally kind of got the rest of the story. I wasn't happy that there was a rest of the story, but we got through it, got her the help that she needed. But it's been a long struggle, and I think that's our complaint maybe through the whole process, that we just felt like we didn't get information like we needed to. And I felt like I had to put on my attorney hat and
dig in a little bit.
Really dig in and advocate for her.
So when you say the rest of the story, just basically without going into too much detail, because this is your daughter's privacy, but she had not been well treated in her earlier foster home.
She had some sort of abuse in the prior home, but it's so difficult because she could not verbalize a whole lot of that. So we got behavior. So typically, you know, you see a kid who's had a bad experience, so we got a lot of behavior. But our frustration was that the system knew that. They understood that something bad had happened there, but we didn't know. So that was hard. It was hard to receive her in that. I can't even describe how chaotic it was. I had to take lots of time off of work because we had to have two adults to manage her at all times. We were calling in help from friends. Todd and I took shifts over the night to help watch her. So we were actually doing awake overnight care because this was so difficult.
Yeah, because you were afraid she'd hurt herself.
And hurt my other children in my house and hurt us, which she did do regularly.
Well, it's amazing that you stuck with it. Other people might have said, forget it, you know?
You know, we saw a lot of hope in her. And so her middle name is now Hope after we adopted her, because we saw some hope in her. She's really the most intelligent little child I've ever met. And we couldn't give up on her.
Jeanette, one of your jobs is to recruit foster families. How do you interpret this story that we just heard from Deb?
Wow. It's a painful story, but it is so inspirational. And I guess the message of Deb's story is that of love and perseverance. And we ask that of all foster families. I don't think anybody portrays fostering or adopting as an easy thing to do. These are children who need so much love and so much special attention. So we ask people to be prepared to give that. Now, we don't necessarily ask them to be surprised or as surprised as Deb and her family were, and it's really unfortunate that that happened. But the fact that they were willing not to give up and to demand the resources that they needed to care for this child is amazing to me.
What jumps out for me, in addition to what you said about, you know, maybe she should have known, but Kelly talked about, you know, emergency situations and sometimes things happen quickly, is you wonder about the other foster family, Jeanette. Like, how carefully were they vetted? Because it turns out they had abused this little girl, and that's partly why she had so many problems.
You do have to wonder about that. We certainly all screen and vet to the best of our ability. But certainly I acknowledge that things can go wrong, and at least it was recognized. And I don't know the situation prior to Deb's. I'm hoping it was recognized quickly and that the child was moved from that system quickly and placed with Deb quickly.
Can you shed some light on the vetting process for us, Ellen? Eileen, how carefully families are vetted to make sure that these things don't happen?
Sure. But before I do that, Laura, with your permission, I just sort of like to acknowledge just a couple things that Deb had said earlier. I think when I opened my comments, I talked about the courage that foster families really have to have. And I think Deb has and her family have exemplified that courage. You asked if things how things were. And I have to tell you, quite honestly, I do think things are getting better, because for the last 3.5 years, we have recognized that children who come into our system have experienced deep, intense trauma. There's not one child that comes into the child welfare system that has not been traumatized by some type of circumstance. So to react to that, DCYF was very proactive. We received we partnered with Dartmouth Trauma Interventions Research Center to really work with our foster families, to work with our provider community, and to work with our children to help all these populations really understand the effects of trauma, the effects of trauma on the child, the effects of trauma on their behavior, and the effects of trauma and its manifestation within the family unit. So we've sort of been attacking that issue sort of as proactively as we possibly can in the public. And then as a result of some of our efforts that we've made through the grant with Dartmouth, we applied for another grant through the Administration for Children and Families, which is the federal oversight for our agency. And they gave us additional resources to do adoption, promotion, and preservation activities to help deal with some of the issues that I think that Deb was alluding to earlier. And part of that grant gave us the opportunity to actually research state-of-the-art home study models.
So improving, looking at who are these foster families, how are we vetting these families.
So about 18 months ago, the division did a structural change in that we moved from our traditional home study process to a more an evidence-based practice called the SAFE tool, which is a structured analysis family evaluation tool, which really, as I said, it's evidence-based. We trained all of our staff that we could train on how to do a SAFE evaluation of families. And the difference between the SAFE tool and our traditional home study is that it's much more focused on analytic and evaluative skills of that of the resources that that worker brings when actually studying that family.
So you've beefed up the vetting process. Did you want to jump in, Kelly, on that idea of how families are chosen and how we make sure that they are appropriate to take care of kids who, as Eileen says, have already experienced trauma just by being removed from their original home?
It's a very extensive process. It's a very lengthy training process that I know I've been a part of their training classes, and it's every topic from how to work with birth parents to trauma to attachment to loss and grief and cultural issues. And it's, I think, 24 hours. There's also a home study process. So a social worker comes out to the home, sees the home, meets the people. It is an extensive process. However, what I would say, though, is that we can train and train and train and train. And it's not until you get that kiddo in your home that you're like, oh, now I get it. It's kind of like getting married. We can date and date and date and date. And it's like, oh, that's what I married. So it is a long process. But I also know that having done this work for so long that our foster parents come with their own stuff. They come with their own story. They come with their own losses and grief and traumas. And it's sometimes these kiddos push their buttons and their triggers. And sometimes that doesn't look so pretty.
So
do see that that happens at times.
So even if you've been through all the training, you're wonderful, your house is all set, there's certain things in your own background that get triggered by what that individual child brings to you.
And the SAFE home study does a better job of looking at that. But the kid still hasn't moved in the home yet. So sometimes, well, a lot of times, it's when that child moves in that my stuff gets pushed. And then that impacts my parenting skills and my patience and tolerance and things like that.
We have so much more to talk about in just a moment after a break. And you can join us, too, with your questions, comments, personal experiences. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. The number 1-800-892-6477. More in a moment.
Good?
Yeah. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the foster care system here in New Hampshire. Shortages of families and rising need and resources has left a vital part of our child protection system struggling. We're hearing more. The Exchange number for you to join us with your comments, questions, personal experiences with this is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have four guests with us: Jeanette Burge, Program Director and Social Worker at Child and Family Services, a New Hampshire nonprofit. She works with foster families. Deb Urbatus, a foster adoptive parent and an attorney who specializes in family law. Kelly Smith is here, clinical social worker with long experience working with adoptive and foster families. And Eileen Mullen, administrator at DCYF, where she also works with foster families and children. And all of you, let's go to our listeners now. And in Keene, Jennifer's calling in. Hi, Jennifer. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Give me 2 seconds. I gotta go out in the other room. All right. Hello.
Hi, Jennifer. Go ahead.
So I don't even know where to start. I've been on kind of both ends of DCYF. This started when I was 15. I was the victim of a horrible traumatic rape that resulted in a pregnancy and a child. And as my family raised me as a Christian, they did not believe in abortion. So my father planned to raise the child. Sadly, he died when I was 6 months pregnant. And my mom wasn't really ready for all of it. DCYF had kind of got involved, and nonetheless, they had adopted my child out, of whom is now 19 and in my life very actively, but also was abused in the home they placed her in for 11 years.
So your child, Jennifer, just to make sure I'm following the dots right here, was placed in the foster care system.
She was.
And she was abused in that system.
Yes. And, you know, over the years, I mean, I never would say that I can't admit that I had some messy parts in my life. You know, I certainly had my poor choices that led to my children being removed. I had other children that were removed, two other children at a much, much later date. A lot of that was, you know, I had proof that the woman that called the state repeatedly, admitted she did it and laughed in my face because she just didn't like me. And, you know, she was married to my ex-husband. So, you know, and the state knew that.
Well, Jennifer, let's talk about this. We covered this a little bit in our earlier segment, but it sounds like we should talk about it a little bit more. You know, just the idea, and maybe I'll turn to you, Deb, that, you know, Eileen talked about efforts now to improve the vetting system. You talked a lot about this SAFE program, but it does sound like in the past, and not too distant past, with your daughter's situation, mm-hmm. there have been some families who have not been stellar.
Sure, I think that happens everywhere. But I think, too, there's other layers to that. In a family that's already a foster family, if there are other children that are in that home, just exactly like Eileen said, there are kids in other homes that are also foster kids who have their own baggage. They have their own trauma history. And so that also changes the family dynamic. So those are hard things, and it's hard for workers to know if they place, you know, another child like my child into a home with other children. How are they all going to react? What's that family dynamic going to be like? So there are multiple layers of that vetting process and how that should happen, and they're not easy, and they take time. And since they have been very short-staffed, it's hard. I mean, I can tell you, you know, we only even saw our social worker from DCYF maybe once a month. And that's what they need to do. That's what they have to do. And I'm glad that they have confidence in us. But at the same time, not having really frequent contact and things like that make it maybe harder.
So a little more backup from the social workers would have helped you when you were struggling
sure.
with your issues with your daughter. And this
sure.
gets back to the staffing we talked about,
right.
Eileen. Ideally, how often would you have somebody checking in on a foster family like Deb's?
Ideally, we would love those caseworkers to be available to those foster parents upon the foster parent request.
Whenever they call.
Whenever
say,
they
I'm
call.
Having an issue,
ideally,
help me out.
Yes, because anyone that's ever heard me speak publicly about foster care knows that I always say a strong foster care system is the backbone of the child welfare system. Mm-hmm. If we do not nurture, support, meet the needs of our foster families, then we will have an ineffective child welfare system. But I Also, Jennifer, if you're still on the line, I just wanted to acknowledge your pain, and I'm sorry for your life circumstances, but I can tell you that we are committed to making sure that those types of things do not happen to any other child that enters our system. That is one of the reasons why we actually moved to this safe home study model. One, to ensure that we are putting children in safe environments. And two, it also works towards building sort of a deeper, richer foster adoptive family pool. In order, we were speaking at the break about the matching process, and Deb was saying that oftentimes within family systems that you may be bringing children into a family where it may not actually be a good fit. If we could spend more time with a deeper pool of families, if we could actually spend more time doing the matching process, when part of the SAFE study does have sort of this compatibility index, which really, you know, the family fills out, you know, this is what I would like to see in a child, and the child fills out, in, you know, his sections, and this is what I'd like to have in a family. So ideally, you know, we can match those two instruments together and come up with the best match. Without a deeper, richer pool, sometimes that doesn't happen.
Well, that makes
but
a ton of
striving
sense.
Striving towards...
You can get a better match when you have more foster families
exactly.
to choose from.
Exactly.
So how do you, Jeanette, this is where you come in, how do you go about encouraging more Granite Staters to join in to this system?
You know, actually, and I'm glad you asked this because this is where the numbers are so critical. I believe that when people really understand the need and really understand what our children need, they step up. Granite Staters are amazing volunteers. I come from the volunteer state, so I know volunteerism.
And Is that Tennessee, by the way? It is Tennessee, okay.
yes. I have seen people step up at a moment's notice when they understand the need. And so our role at Child and Family Services, part of our role, is to go out and express this need all across the state and recruit families. We actually recruit families who are willing to nurture children with a higher level of need, but we're also trying to recruit families for DCYF as well. And people step up when they understand, and when they understand that we want them.
I have a couple questions from our listeners on that topic. And here's an email from Emily in Milton, who says, while I understand the need to carefully vet potential foster parents, which is what you've raised, Deb, and our caller also raised, Emily says, I wonder if there might be a few too many hoops in some respects. Emily says, we are a family with two children who wanted to become a foster family. Unfortunately, we live in an old house which can't realistically be modified to fully meet the requirements. Emily says, we were heartbroken to find that we can't become foster parents while living in this house. I understand the need to make sure children are in a safe environment, but I wonder if there might be too many boxes to check in the process, especially when our state is desperate for strong, committed families in which to place children in need. Emily, thank you so much. This is a question I had for you, Kelly. You know, it's kind of the flip side. We talked a couple minutes ago about making sure that, you know, children aren't placed in abusive homes, and that's just terrible for them, obviously. But are we, as Emily says, sometimes making families check too many boxes?
That's a great question and point, Emily. And I know my family also lives in a 300-year-old home, and we were going to become foster parents for a particular youth, and we also couldn't become foster parents because it was our windows. But here's the other...
Your windows. What went wrong with your windows?
Oh, they're too big. They're too small. They're crooked. They just don't meet the standards. And it's around fire inspection. It's around fire standards. And I appreciate it because if there was a fire in my house, some of my windows we would not be able to get out of. And if I had a child living in that room, that would be devastating. So I get it. Boy, we do have a lot of standards, but they're there for safety. Yet, how many fires do we really have in our house?
So how did you resolve that
situation? We didn't. We walked alongside this young lady, and we became a primary caring adult, which is another need. It's called a PCA. And those are people that will walk alongside a 16-plus-year-old youth and as they age out of care. And you become their mentor. Once they're 18, they can come and stay at your home. My PCA actually called last night at 9 o'clock and needed a place to be, so she's back home with us for a while.
That's sort of an alternative to, if you can't do, you know, the full-scale foster parenting, you can do this for older kids.
And we have a huge need for our kids who are aging out of the system. They're 18 and they're couch surfing. Who do they call when they get evicted? Who do they call when they need to fill out a college application? Who do they call when they're in the emergency room? Where do they go for Christmas dinner? So PCAs are an amazing resource that our kids need and deserve.
Can you, Eileen, also real quickly address Emily's concern? You know, she wanted to be a foster family, but there were too many hoops to jump through.
You know, unfortunately, Emily, I've heard your story so many times about those windows. And I would like your listeners to know, and especially you, Emily, that the fire safety code is not set by the state. It is set by local ordinances within different towns. So many towns have different specifications that they want from homes. We have some towns go as far to say that a foster home is actually a landlord or a tenant type of structure. Other towns, basically, they want to make sure that a fire person can get in and out of that house with, you know, the fire prevention gear on. That's what they require for the windows. We have been working with the fire marshal's office. We know it's an issue. We're trying to resolve it. We would like some consistency among the life safety code throughout the state. It's heartbreaking. You know, who can afford to replace all their windows? You know, Kelly in her 300-year-old house, there's probably 50 windows. You know, incredibly expensive.
Well, thank you so much, Emily, for the email. And let's go back to our callers. And Pam is in Bedford. Hi, Pam. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, my question is, when there's such a need for foster families, what can a single parent be a foster parent? I raised my children. They're now adults. I did, I think, a fabulous job with them. They're awesome adults. I'd be interested in doing it, but I am not married. Does that mean that I'm not eligible?
Pam, great question. And Jeanette, you want to handle that?
I sure do. One of the things I love to say is, to be a foster parent, you don't have to be married, you don't have to be rich, and you don't have to own your own home.
But you do have to have a safe home, as
we discussed. You have to have a safe home.
And sometimes that's hard.
Yes.
Yeah.
So please step up to the plate.
Yeah, okay. Go ahead, Kelly.
The other thing I would say from a clinical perspective, sometimes our kids do best in single homes because there isn't the intimacy of family. We don't have then spouses who have their own conflicts. They don't have one parent thinks to parent this way, another parent thinks to discipline and parent this way, so the kid gets caught up in the middle of that. So I'm all for single parenting.
All right.
It works really well for our kids.
Are you saying that parents sometimes disagree on parenting?
It's just a few times.
Just once in a while. Okay. Let's take another call. Thank you so much for that one. It's an important point. And Chris is in Dover. Go ahead, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. So I actually was a foster and adoptive parent. I adopted a child, and I fostered another child who had severe emotional behavioral issues. So I know the heartache and the stress of, you know, both successful adoptions and adoptions that don't happen, and the care for, you know, kids who have really high needs. But the point that I want to make is that, I mean, down to every last one, every single person I've ever met who works for the Department of Health and Human Services are committed people, and they really are, you know, doing their best to work in the best interest of the child. But consistently, our legislature has not funded DHHS to the levels that it needs to. So when we hear about really high caseloads, you know, the ones that keep our caseworkers from having the regular appointments or maybe having, you know, enough time and attention for each case, you know, particularly the ones that lead to, you know, the recent deaths of a couple of children in state care, there has to be some collective responsibility that we're all willing to take, because we haven't funded the agency to the level it tells us that it needs to have enough people to take care of all the foster kids and all the kids in state care.
Well,
that's
Chris,
ultimately my comment.
Thank you so much for the comment. And to follow up on her call, and I'll throw this to you, Eileen, Pat sent us an email earlier in Chichester asking, how many social workers do you need? How many are you authorized? And how many have you managed to hire and retain? Pat also asks, how much do you think the low-wage package has to do with your inability to fill these positions. And we talked about this a couple weeks ago in our program on DCYF. But go ahead, Eileen. Can you answer some of these questions, at least from Pat?
Yes. Thank you, Pat and Chris, for your calls. To answer your question, I know that we have been actively, our agency or the department as a whole has been actively recruiting new staff to fill our vacant positions. I don't think, I think most people know that we have had a staff shortage, and we have been very proactive in trying to meet the needs of that staff shortage so that we can meet the needs of the kids and the families that need us most out in the field. We just did a new worker orientation on Tuesday, and I think we had 50 new people, 50 new faces sitting in that orientation.
50 so, or 15?
50. Yes, new faces. Now, granted, that was across the whole division. They weren't all CPSWs, but that was 50 new people that we've welcomed into our agency and trying to get them all trained up so that we can better meet the needs of kids and families.
CPSWs,
Child Protective Service Workers.
Service worker. Yes. So what would be ideal, Eileen, so that you could be assured that someone like Deb, who really could have used a little extra support, pat on the back, whatever. What's the ideal number for you? Do you have one?
I don't have that, Laura, at this point.
Yeah. Did you want to jump in, Kelly?
I would just say it's not just DCYF that has a staff shortage. It's everywhere. Schools are struggling with hiring paraprofessionals. I know some residential programs I do some consulting to, and they are struggling with residential staff that work directly with the kids. I do some consulting with the area agencies that serve developmentally disabled individuals, and they are struggling hiring those direct care staff that work with the individuals and clients, because it is a lower paid position, and it is the hardest job there is working directly with the kids and families. So it's not just the division, it's our entire state that's really in an employment situation.
Well, thank you for that call, Pam. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We're taking your questions, comments, stories, concerns about New Hampshire's foster care system today in the exchange. 1-800-892-6477. Deb, I wanted to ask you, in terms of your own experience, how much financial help you got from the state. I think sometimes people feel like, oh, people just get into foster care, you know, so they can get money. But from what I've read, the money is quite low. So how much financial assistance do you get?
Sure. It depends on what sort of home that you are providing. So if you're a basic, a regular foster home for DCYF, it's anywhere between $22 and $27 a day that you get to have the child in your home. We are an ISO foster home through CFS, so the allotment per day is more to do that work. But what I would say is that you don't exactly get ahead by doing this, because
nobody's making money off of being a foster parent.
Well, you have to feed the child, clothe the child, but there's a lot of time that you miss from work because this child, especially ours, had to go to an appointment almost every single day. We were in the position where we needed to do some of the transportation for school for a period of time. She had attended Crotchet Mountain, so we had to drive to and from Crotchet Mountain for the first several weeks of her, time going there. So that was, it's 35 minutes from our house, so a couple hours a day in the car.
Wow.
Yeah.
You spend that much money just on food and gas.
Easily.
Never mind anything else.
Absolutely.
All right, we'll pick up on that after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Ideas come naturally to writers.
Ah, I wish.
But how are they with deadlines?
I would say probably 5 times in the history of my column have I gotten it done during the day on Monday. And it's the most incredible feeling. Like, if you could distill that feeling and grind it into a powder, I would snort it.
Apparently, they're just like the rest of us. Whether you're looking for inspiration or commiseration, subscribe to the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop on iTunes or Google Play.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at New Hampshire's foster care system. And let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. your comments about the foster care system, your question about how it works, or your personal experiences with this system are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter at nhpr. Exchange. So, Deb, just before the break, you were talking about your own experience as a foster adoptive parent and definitely not in it for the money. In fact, it sounds like it's a losing financial proposition, which is fine. You don't do it for the money, but.
Right. You don't do this for the money. You do this because you have a passion to see kids step through this really hard experience that they've had, and maybe they can come out on the other end in a much better place and set up for a much better life. So it is tough. It's a tough thing, and you do have to spend a lot of your own time and a lot of your own effort. We do get support. You know, we're a CFS ISO foster home.
So that means Child and Family Services.
Right, an individualized service option. That means the kids that we take in have a much higher need than the average child. But remember, every kid who enters care has a trauma history. So they all have something going on. The kids that we're receiving into our home have a little more than the average something going on. So there's more support. We have a once a week visit. When we were fostering, we had a once a week visit from our CFS worker. There's just more support there. There's a little more financial support there. And honestly, we had some CFS workers who did a great job helping us get some support for our little girl that was outside the box. We advocated for a service dog for our little girl and advocated for that with our judge and with everyone in the system, and finally managed to get through a lot of help from CFS, the funding to help bring us a service dog.
CFS, again, is Jeanette's organization. Absolutely. Child and Family Services, yeah. The nonprofit. You know, I have to ask you this. Was this your first experience fostering?
No.
When you brought this little girl into your home?
No, actually, we know Kelly from a long time ago when we had a young lady in our home way back in 2004. I started fostering in 2001 with a young lady from our youth group. DCYF came to me and said, hey, would you like to foster? Sure. We have somebody that needs a home. So I went through the whole process and fostered starting back then. So we've had a number of young people in our home.
You've been doing this for a long time then.
Yeah, off and on, but yes, for a long time. And we had a young lady before our current child who was a teenage child coming through the juvenile justice system. So,
and you have two children of your own.
We do, a 10 and a 6-year-old, both boys, and they're our biological boys, and they have gigantic hearts, I would
say. How do they feel about kids coming in and out?
Some days they're perfectly accepting, and some days they think that we're crazy, and they tell us that, and they have big voices, and they're definitely heard. And some days they treat our little girl just like she's their regular sister, and there's no issues, and other days they come to us, and they say, what in the world did you do? And we say, someday, even our judge told them on adoption day, you guys, someday you're going to understand what a big gift you've given to this little girl. And some days they know and some days they don't.
Oh, they're kids.
They are kids. We work through it.
You wanted to jump in, Jeanette.
Yes, thank you. First, Deb, I'm so glad you mentioned the dog. I can't tell you how happy it made all of us when we were finally able to help that happen. Mm-hmm. But I want to go back to the rates for a minute. We need the legislature to authorize higher rates for foster families. Not as much for the specialized homes like CFS recruits, but for the state-level homes. That requires a legislative action, and we need the legislature to act on that. Foster families shouldn't lose money when they're trying to take care of our children.
Let's take another call, and this is Kathy in Concord. Hi, Kathy. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with
us.
Hi.
Thanks.
Sure. Go ahead, Kathy.
So my comment was basically, my husband and I were actually foster parents with DCYF for about 10 years, and we had a little over 30 kids during that time period. And the biggest issue that we always had, and my question is more for DCYF, the biggest question we always had was with DCYF, actually. It wasn't the kids. So what I am wondering is if DCYF, and I have some examples, but I'm not sure if you want them, if what DCYF has done or is planning to do to try to correct some of these issues with communication. And we had two little girls that were brought to us one day on a Friday afternoon that the social workers dropped them off and didn't even know the kids' names.
Wow.
They were 3 and 10 months.
Little. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. We had no idea for sure what their names were even until Monday. We had no paperwork. If there had been an emergency over the weekend, we had no authorization for medical services. There was, things like that. We had another set of kids where we were basically yelled at by the social worker to try to work with the birth mom to get her kids back, which is part of what we're supposed to do is, you know, that's usually the goal, is to try to be able to place the kids back with the parents. In a different situation with a different set of kids, it was the opposite thing, where they were continuing to give unsupervised visits to a mom that clearly was not able to do that. She actually got into a fist fight during a supervised visit with her 5-year-old daughter. Wow.
So lots of balls dropped, it sounds like, Kathy. And when was all this, by the way, just so we can kind of put in context?
We stopped fostering about 3 years ago. So it was over that whole 10-year time period. This was all different kids that we worked with over that 10-year time period.
Well, good
so I'm
for
wondering
you for,
if things have changed.
Yeah. Good for you for helping out, Kathy, by the way, in a big, big way. Thank you for calling in. And Eileen, what do you think? Sounds like just information crossed and lots of stress and just I's not being dotted and T's not being crossed.
And Kathy, I apologize for your experience, and I really hope that would not happen today with some of the current structural changes that we've made within the agency so that we can actually be more responsive to the needs of foster and adoptive families. We, oftentimes our agency works in a crisis mode. Friday afternoons, 4 o'clock, historically, that's when we get those calls that this child needs a placement right now.
Why is that, Eileen?
Friday, 4 o'clock, I think people are panicked about the weekends. Maybe schools are calling because they've seen a situation at school that they don't feel comfortable about. Maybe that's the time that court has their regularly scheduled, family court dates. It's Fridays, historically, within child welfare systems, not just in New Hampshire. Fridays tend to be those crisis dates. And the Fridays, and usually the day before summer vacation. That's when our agency really gets a lot of calls for services.
Wow. So the social workers are seeing a situation and they go, you know what? I don't want to let this go over the weekend.
Exactly. Or we don't have enough information to actually make that assessment as to what would. And we're always going to err on the side of caution, safety first and foremost. So it's really hard for me to fathom that you would have children would be dropped off at someone's house when we didn't even know their name. Because quite frankly, within the agency, we try to work in a very family-centered approach. We try to get as much information about that child, even if it is an emergency or a crisis situation. We work with those parents so that we can provide adequate information to their placement provider so that we're not causing further harm. The practice now is if that child is placed in foster care, and perhaps Deb can speak to this, we really like those children to have a phone call with their birth parents as soon as they possibly can, or at least before they go to bed, so that it's more calming and reassuring and reducing some of the additional trauma that the child is facing at this point in time. So all I can say, Kathy, is I'm sorry for your experiences, and if you'd like to call me later, I'm willing to speak to you further about some of your experiences.
Well, Kathy, I appreciate the call. And I wonder, Jeanette, what's the role of people at nonprofits like yours, volunteers, professionals like you, in kind of filling the gaps where an underfunded DCYF just sometimes cannot?
We frequently get calls from DCYF asking us to step in if they have a child that needs a placement. We do everything we can to make a good match, because the matching, again, is just so critical, not only for a great experience for a child, but just not to re-traumatize the child.
Right, because there's already trauma there.
Yes.
If you've been removed from your home.
Yes. So when DCYF calls us, we make every effort to make a good match for a child and to get all of the information we can about that child and to make a good placement. We have the luxury of being able to visit families more often because we are able to keep our caseloads lower. We aren't mandated by the state to take a certain number of children. DCYF can't say no. If we don't think we can adequately serve a child, we will say no, and they will call another agency. So we have the luxury of paying more attention than a public system might be able to support our foster families.
You know, something else our caller said, she would have liked some help in terms of interactions with the birth parents. I'll turn to you first. I think, Kelly, nationally, about 50% of kids in the foster care system do go back to their parents. What do you see in New Hampshire over your long time working in this field? Is it common, uncommon?
I can give you numbers from CASA because I also work for them. So in 2016, 40% of our cases were closed. When they were closed, it was because of reunification with biological family. So I would imagine that 40, 50% would be accurate.
Yeah. And what happens in the other cases?
About 20, 25% are adopted. 12 to 20%, 15 to 20% probably are guardianship. Some cases are dismissed. Kids age out of the system. So, but our largest, our highest percentage is the 40% that are reunified.
Mm. I also read about another trend, and maybe I'll ask you about this, Eileen, that while about half the kids in foster care are reunified, and again, this is national numbers that I looked at, that number is going down slightly, that slightly fewer kids are being reunified with their biological parents. We've talked on this program a lot about, you know, those horrible deaths and kids who were reunified with mothers who clearly should not have had them because they were violent, and the little girls ended up dying. Is that a trend in New Hampshire, Eileen, where reunification is still the main name of the game, but a little bit less so?
Right. We have federal mandates that say that we must try to reunify that child as fast as we possibly can using that family-centered approach in working with families. If that is not possible within 12 months, that's when the agency moves into a different stage of planning where we develop a concurrent plan for that child. If it's determined or it seems that that child will not be going home within that 12-month window of time, the courts, like we work jointly with the courts and other systems, if it appears that the child would not be going home, then we start working on that other plan, which could be adoption. And most of the children, we had 86 adoptions last year in New Hampshire.
And through the foster care
through
system.
Through our foster care system, mm-hmm. Exactly. And sort of an interesting change to that number is the number of relative care adoptions. I know we spoke briefly about this earlier, but relatives are really stepping up and of the 23 relative care adoptions, 12 of them were grandparent adoptions. So remember, it takes a little time. We've got that whole one-year window that we're to work intensively with that birth family. And we're asking foster parents to work with us as part of the team, as part of the partnership, to get those children back home if they can be returned safely. If not, the foster parents are then stepping up to the plate and saying, fine, you know, this is your permanent home. This is where you are going to stay. I think Deb alluded to that earlier in some of the issues I think that she was experiencing with her daughter, that finally her daughter, it's dawning on her daughter that this isn't a temporary placement. Mm. This is my forever family.
I have a very dear friend who is a foster parent and has had several older kids. And one boy, I guess he's around 10, and, you know, just fell in love with him, of course, and wanted to adopt, but it was assessed. And obviously, nobody can comment on this particular case on the air, but it was just one of those heartbreaking cases where she loved him. She wanted to adopt him. But the goal is to get him reunified. And she felt like the mom was not appropriate. But of course, you know, the biological family comes first. So it's just, I just imagine it's really hard to make those assessments, Eileen, right?
Like, well, I think that's why we say the foster parenting is such a difficult job. Not only is it emotionally and financially taxing, but to have to see a child return home that you do not feel is going to be as safe in his parents' home as that child may be in someone else's home, that's very, very difficult. But I always remind foster parents that you never know what difference you have made in the life of that child. I don't know the situation of your friend, but that young man at least knows that there's another caring person out in this world that I can turn to if, in fact, my safety feels compromised.
Mm, just like you talked about
yes.
earlier, Kelly. Can you address this as well, Deb? Again, you are a foster adoptive parent. You adopted your daughter, but you told us earlier you had a number of children in your home.
We did.
What's that push-pull between, you know, fall in love with this kid. I want to keep him or her.
Sure. So the young people that we have been all teenagers prior to the little girl that we have now. So there was always some work with their biological parents. The first young lady I had was aging out of the system, but we did work with her mom because she was going to wind up going back to mom. So we did do some work with her, and she actually wound up going back to Colorado where her mom was. So we do that work. Sometimes what you're doing is just trying to open those lines of communication, and maybe you just send an email to the bio parent to say, hey, this is what's going on, and helping to reassure them that the child is being well taken care of. It's not easy, certainly, and when a child does return, that's perhaps a little bit hard, a little heartbreaking, but we've, at this point now that we get to keep ours, we're pretty happy about that.
What's the fix that this system needs? Kelly, I'll turn to you first. What is it?
Oh,
I'm giving you the magic wand.
No kidding.
With 30
Laura,
seconds
goodness.
Left in the show.
So the fix would be we need people to come forward and help in any way, become a primary caring adult and walk alongside our older kids, become a CASA volunteer and advocate in the court system, become an emergency foster parent, become a foster adoptive parent. If you're a social worker, come work in the field. I've been doing it for 27 years. I can't imagine doing anything else. It's beautiful work.
Eileen, do you want to jump in on that real quick?
Yeah, I would. I just wanted to also mention that we have a lot of support throughout the state through our business partnerships and some of our professional partnerships. Wendy's restaurant people have been extremely supportive of the work of our foster and adoptive families. So every time you buy a Frosty and get that coupon book, that money goes right back to foster and adoptive families.
You're making me want a hamburger right now.
Same here. Can it be like Park? Every summer they hold an event for all of our kids in our system and their families and their foster families. So we are fortunate that we are in New Hampshire, that we have so many people that are committed to really providing services and supports to our safety network. So
right.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, all of you, thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Laura.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.